when Ahaz refused to ask for a sign, God gave him that sign anyway. We see that in chapter 7, verse 14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. So that was the prophecy that he gave concerning Ephraim and Syria, who were coming down against Judah. King Ahaz of Judah has made an alliance, an ungodly alliance with Assyria. He's going to follow through with that and not trust the Lord. The consequences of that are laid out for us in the last part of chapter 7. Then when we get to verse 8, here's what happens with Isaiah. Then the Lord said to me, this is chapter 8, then the Lord said to me, take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters. Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. And I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest, and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. I guess if anyone can pronounce that better, let me know. So I approached the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. Then the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the boy knows how to cry out, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoils of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. Again, the Lord spoke to me further, saying, inasmuch as the people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh and rejoice in Rezin, the son of Remaliah, now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will rise up over its channels and over all its banks. Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck. And the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand. For God is with us. So we have a lot of similarities here in these first four verses of chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, that are a lot of parallels with chapter 7, verses 10 through 17. You see him talking here in these first four verses about the conception of a child, giving birth to a son, the naming of that son. And what we are looking at is what I walked us through that passage on Emmanuel in chapter 7, what we saw is that it has this Emmanuel prophecy has a dual fulfillment. There had to be some fulfillment of that prophecy in the time of Ahaz so that he would know that what God was saying to him was right and was true. But then there's the future fulfillment, which we understand to be the birth of Christ, God with us. That's the child that we understand to have been the later fulfillment of that. And so when we get to chapter 8, we're seeing here the fulfillment of this prophecy in the time of Ahaz. And we're going to see in these verses how that came about. So the significance of the sign is the same. Before a child reaches a certain age, the enemies of Samaria and Damascus are no longer going to be a threat to Judah. They're going to be wiped out. They're going to be taken care of. So this partial fulfillment of this prophecy, the first fulfillment of it in Ahaz's time, is in these first four verses. But it's also, as we've just said, it's a bigger part of this Emmanuel prophecy that we're going to see when we get to 8:10, when we get to the 10th verse of this chapter. Isaiah in chapter 8 begins, he switches to first person. So instead of God speaking, Ahaz begins to speak, and what he has done in doing this is made himself, which you're going to see is necessary, he's made himself an active participant in this prophecy of God and the sign that God is going to give to his people. And this is something that is personal for Isaiah. We've seen it from the beginning. He's not disconnected from the things that the accusations that he's bringing against God's people. He's very much feeling the weight and the burden of the sin of his nation, of this country that he loves dearly. And so this is personal for him. And God allows him to get personally involved in the fulfilling of this prophecy. And the prophecy that's going to take place right in front of Ahaz's face, the fulfillment of it, take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters. So God is giving Isaiah instructions to that he is supposed to do these things. And so God tells him to take this tablet, this large tablet. Apparently God wants this to be big enough so that everybody can read it. He's going to write an oracle on this tablet. He wants it big enough so that everyone can read it. Now, he tells him to write it in ordinary letters. It's not real clear exactly what is meant by that, but most likely God is giving Isaiah instructions to write this oracle in a script that is going to be easily read, something that, and write it in such a way that everyone can understand it, everyone can read it. That would have meant that God would have had to supernaturally help me write something physically with my hand so that you could all read it, because my handwriting is horrible. But God's telling Isaiah, write this in such a way on a big tablet where everyone can read it and it can be seen. I don't want anybody to miss what's about to happen. And so what is he supposed to write on this tablet? He's supposed to write, swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. Anybody have any idea what that means? Well, let's see if we can figure it out. First of all, it is the translation of Maher Shalal Hashbash. It is the translation of the name that Isaiah gives to his son. Now, it's not clear whether this name was an actual name that was given to people, or if this was the prophecy that God wanted, that oracle that God wanted written, and Isaiah named his son that for emphasis. So we're not real sure if that was a name. It's certainly not one that is seen common in other places. So most likely, it's possible that he named him this just to named his son this to emphasize the prophecy. Maybe a better way for us to understand it, translating it from Hebrew, would be this: speeding to the plunder, hurrying to the spoil. Because what's about to happen? God's about to turn loose the Assyrians on Judah, right? The Assyrians are the ones they've made the alliance with, and we've seen a couple weeks ago that they're going to turn on Judah, and they're going to make things very, very difficult for that nation. And so he's telling the prophecy that's being written, the oracle that's being written out on this large tablet in words where everyone can read it, is, hey, there's an army that's speeding towards plunder. They're hurrying towards the spoil. They are coming after you, is basically what this oracle is saying. So this tablet actually predicts two things. It predicts, number one, the attack that's going to take place by Assyria, the attack that's coming. It also predicts the birth of the child who is going to be the sign to Ahaz. Now, look in verse 2. I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony. And God names two of them. He names Uriah and he names Zechariah. Now, both of these, you can find Uriah in 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 10 through 16. He was one of Ahaz's priests. And God is saying, you're going to write this tablet out and you're going to do it in front of two witnesses. You're going to go and you're going to get these two men who were high standing in politics in the nation of Judah, the priests to the people that were supposed to represent the people before God. And he says, you're going to get this tablet. You're going to write this in letters where everyone can read it. You're going to do it right in front of these two priests, these two leaders of this nation of Judah. There's a couple of reasons for this. Number one, they are supposed to, as priests, they should have been warning the people about the things that God was going to hold them accountable for. They had God's word. They should have been calling the people to, if you remember, the things that Isaiah has been trying to tell the people that they failed at, the idea of justice and righteousness and doing the system that God had given them for the removal of their sin had become a religious system, and it was that they were worshiping and not worshiping God himself. And so they should have been ones that were calling them out on it. And now here's Isaiah having to call them out. And God is saying to these guys, listen, if you are going to be party of the apostasy that's taking place, if you're going to take part of that, if you're going to support Ahaz in his ungodly alliance with a pagan nation, and you're not, and you know he's not going to trust me, and you're not going to call him on it, I'm not going to let you get by with that without some accountability. And so he sends Isaiah's prophet to them. And if they are going to turn away from God, his priests are going to turn away from him, they are going to do it deliberately. They're going to have to do it with a warning that's going to be given to him. And so God sends him to it to write this tablet in their presence. And by doing that, knowing that this tablet is not only signifying and predicting the coming of Assyria, but it's also signifying the birth of the child that's going to be a sign of that attack. It also puts Isaiah in such a position where he goes to them before this child is even born. And he stands in front of them and he tells them what God says, and he writes on that tablet in front of them this prophecy. And this will be the name of my son. This is what I will name him. This son is going to be a sign, exactly as God told King Ahaz. And so they've got it written before the child is ever born, and that way they can't accuse him after the child is born of what they would have called prophecy after the fact, that he was making it up. Hey, I told you this was going to happen. And so God's making it very clear that he's the one that's doing this. He's the one that's giving the sign. He's the one that's bringing about the destruction of Judah through the nation of Assyria. And so these public officials are witness to this. And then in verse 3, so we've got the tablet that's the sign, that's the oracle that's written down that affirms the sign that is coming. And in verse 3, Isaiah says he approached the prophetess. Now, in the Old Testament, the term approached or draw near is something that is used several times in a reference to the first time that a husband and wife are together. So that goes along with what the prophecy was, that a virgin was going to give birth to a child, right? So Isaiah takes for himself a wife that she's called a prophetess. Now, she might be labeled that because she's Isaiah's wife, or it's possible that she herself was a prophetess. God used women in the Old Testament in this same way. And so it's possible she could have been. We don't know in one way or the other if that's the reference there. But nonetheless, in verse 3, what we see, she takes for himself a wife who would have been an Alma, who would have been that young woman of marriageable age who had not known a man. So she's a virgin, and they conceive. And then we see, once that takes place in verse 3, that she conceived and she gave birth to a son. And what did they name him? Mahershalal Hashbash. They named him Swift. What is it? Swift is the booty. Let me get back to it. That's it. Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. Did you think your son would hate you the rest of his life? So they give him the name that reflects the oracle that's written on the tablet. And we have more concerning the prophecy of this young man, that is this baby that has been born. Some of it continues, echoes the Emmanuel prophecy that was given back in chapter 7. And what we have in chapter 8 right here actually gives clarity to what we saw back in that chapter. And so now we are 9 months after that Emmanuel prophecy was given, and we know that ultimately both enemies of Samaria, they're going to flee from Judah, and both of them are going to ultimately be plundered. Now, the parallels between Mahershalal Hashbash and Emmanuel prove two things for us. Number one, that Judah's enemies are going to be destroyed, and right along with that, that God can and should be trusted. That's been the whole problem with the nation of Israel for a long time now. They have not trusted God in his ways. And the king himself in chapter 7 refused to trust God. He placed his trust in a political system that he thought he was able to manipulate and play in order to get a mighty power to be on his side. And so before this son of Isaiah who has been born, before he can even say mother or father, this is still in verse 4, we are told that the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria are going to be carried away before or by the king of Assyria. So before he's even able to utter, maybe even uttering mama or dada or papa, or, you know, those things. So if it happened in 732, as most scholars try, you know, they teach us that that's when this downfall of these two nations happened, then he would have been right at a year old, which is right about the time mama or dada starts coming out, right? And so this kid was assigned to Ahaz of what was going to happen. Verse 5, we have another prophecy, another word that the Lord has given to Isaiah to personally speak. And it's not really clear how much time passes between verses 4 and 5. That's still very much related to this prophecy of this child giving indication of what's going to happen when he is born. But we don't know exactly the time that passes. So in verse 6, we see that there's some rejoicing that's going on over rejoicing in Rezin and the son of Remaliah. And so it's quite possible that what they are referring to is when the king of Assyria comes in, and about 734, their enemies are totally wiped out. They've been pushed out of Jerusalem by that time. And so there's what most likely he's referring to here is the people of Judah rejoicing in the fact that their enemies have been overthrown and that have been pushed out. And what that means is they're not rejoicing in the fact that God did it. They're not rejoicing in the fact that they trusted the Lord for it. They're rejoicing in the fact that the king of Assyria, the pagan leader to whom Ahaz sacrificed to his gods and made oaths to these pagan gods, that's the one who they are praising and rejoicing in, that he had delivered them. So they're giving their praise to an earthly king and not to the God who has called them out and set them apart as a nation in this world. And so that's the rejoicing that's going on there. And so in verse 6, we see them referred to as these people. That's pretty telling, that God would refer to the people that he had called out of the world, that he had chosen to be his own, referred to them here as these people. He's done the same thing in chapter 7 when Isaiah was speaking to King Ahaz. You know, he initially referred to Yahweh in verse 11 of chapter 7 as your God. He told the king, ask a sign from the Lord, your God. And then he ends up, before that prophecy is over with, and in verse 13, referring to Yahweh as my God, showing the separation between Yahweh and Ahaz. And now here we see the separation between Yahweh and his people. These people, they have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloh. They've rejected this gently flowing stream. So in calling them these people, in referring to Judah this way, he's reminding them that they can't blame Ahaz for what's about to happen to them. They are just as much to blame as their king. Their fate is sealed by their actions. We've seen that in the first few chapters of this, all the things that they've done throughout the years in rejecting righteousness and rejecting justice. And so their fate is pretty much resting on their shoulders as well. And we can see their lack of trust in God back in chapter 7 in verse 2 when it was reported to the house of David saying the Arameans have camped in Ephraim. His heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. They were terrified of these enemies that were coming against them, showing they had no trust whatsoever in God. And so here these people have rejected what he calls, what the metaphor that is given here is a gently flowing stream, these gently flowing waters of Shiloh. The image that he's giving there is a picture of God's help. Now Shiloh was a slow moving, gently flowing stream that came out of the Kidron Valley, and it brought water to the city of Jerusalem. It flowed to the southern part of the city, and while it was flowing down through there were several places that it filled up pools, which gave them fresh, clear drinking water, life-giving water that they needed there in that city to sustain them. Now, there was a point in time, not in Isaiah's time when King Ahaz was ruling, but when Hezekiah was reigning, there was a tunnel that was dug under the wall that came into the city that actually flowed and brought water into. It's called the Shalom Tunnel. They brought it into the city, which would have been better for an army coming and laying siege to Jerusalem, because now you've got water inside the city that you can drink and you don't have to go outside the protection of the walls in order to get it. But nonetheless, this stream, this Shiloh, stream provided fresh water for the city. And we're going to see a comparison between Shiloh and the river Euphrates here in just a minute. So they're rejoicing at the downfall of their enemies, celebrating this alliance that has gone on. And God is saying, these people, once again, have rejected me. They're worshiping these false gods and worshiping this earthly king for what he's done. And so the tables turn on us, or turn on them in verse 7. Now, therefore, this transition, you can read it as, behold, there's a pronouncement that is about to be made, a pronouncement of judgment that God is about to lay down on his people. As a matter of fact, the verse very plainly says, the Lord is about to. He himself is about to do it. Isaiah is reminding the people that what is going to happen is occurring under the sovereign hand of God himself. You may be worshiping and praising and rejoicing an earthly king, but what you need to understand is that what is fixing to fall on you is being placed on you by the God whom you should be worshiping. And the fear that you may have of any man is wrongly directed. It should be directed to this God whom you have rejected and you have turned away from. So behold, God's about to do something bad to you. What's about to happen is this army is about to come in and sweep over the land. And so God chose the Hebrews to be his people and established them as a nation. And in doing that, a nation has to be more than just a people. It has to have what? It has to have land to occupy, right? It has to have territory to hold. And so the land that they had, who gave them the land? The Lord gave them the land. Who does the land belong to? It belongs to God. Nobody takes what belongs to God or comes in to what belongs to God without God's say-so and without God allowing it. And so what's about to happen to their land, God is about to let it, he's about to let them do it. He's about to let them bring in. God is going to bring them in for the purpose of placing judgment on his people. And so the metaphor that we get here in verse 7, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates. And so we've got this comparison now, the help of God, this gently flowing Shiloh stream that brings life-giving water and sustains life and provides what they need versus the Euphrates, which is this wide river, which is this swift-moving river that's unforgiving, and many times it would flood and rise up out of its banks, and when it overflowed its banks, it just as swift as it was moving within its banks, but it widened out its area and it would wipe out and bring all this great destruction when it would overflow and it would flood. And so God is making a comparison between his help versus the help of the Assyrians. This is what you wanted. You wanted their help. You're going to get it. You've always had that gently flowing stream that provided that life-giving water for you, but you rejected that, and now you want the river Euphrates. Well, then that's what you get, this wild river that overflows its banks and brings great destruction when it comes through. And so that's what we're going to see here, this metaphor for Assyria. It's actually a great metaphor for them, because they had to cross the Euphrates to come into the territory. So they had to cross over that. And when they crossed, they brought this massive army with them that was, at the time, one of, if not the most impressive military might in the world during that time. They were ready to strike at any moment, any time, anywhere, skilled in all types of warfare, and could move quickly. And to some, even when you read the history about them, they seemed superhuman. There was something about the way they were trained that they were just considered superhuman and unstoppable. You could not stop the Assyrian army once it got on the move. And that's one of the reasons that it appealed to Ahaz. He knew they were unbeaten. They were this great military force, and he was going to make this alliance with them. And hey, that would be on our side. We'd have that resource available, and no one would be able to mess with Judah ever again unless that river washed over its banks and flooded into your territory, which is exactly what happens. Ahaz released upon Judah this great torrent, this massive army, deadly, skilled, and just warriors that were trained to kill. And he released that on them, and there's absolutely no escape of it. And so the river overflows its banks in verse 7. The Syrian army is going to sweep across Judah, do this great destruction. Verse 8, it's going to sweep over, overflow, and it will flow and flood up to the point where it reaches up to the neck. So there's going to be so much of it that's going to come into the city. It's not just a flood across Judah that, well, we just have to wade across this to get to our homes. This is going to be a massive invasion that no one can escape. If you remember when we read and looked at it a couple of weeks ago, that was the imagery that Isaiah gave, that you can't get away from this. There's nowhere that you can go, nowhere that you can hide. Every nook and cranny, every cave, every crevice in the wilderness is going to be flooded and covered with these guys. Nowhere that you can go. And so God strengthens that image again, that the flood of this army coming in is going to be so great that it's the flood comes up even to the neck. And so we've got another metaphor in verse 8, not just the overflowing flooding river, but we've got the image of a bird of prey. Look at that in verse 8. The spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. And so you may ask yourself, why in the world is this being worded this way? Why is he has this river metaphor, and then all of a sudden he sticks in this other metaphor about a bird of prey? Well, that's kind of Hebrew poetry. That's the way that happens. You'll read and see that a lot, one metaphor after another, just strengthening the imagery of what's going to happen. And so the idea that now that that this army is going to sweep in with these wide wings like this bird of prey that's flying over the land and looking for what it's going to snatch up and what it's going to carry away. And so we have that metaphor here. But I want you to notice something at the end of verse 8. Who does the land belong to? Okay, the Lord. What name is given right here in verse 8? Emmanuel is given. There's the possessive pronoun your land that is included there, and the your is clarified by O Emmanuel. Isaiah is crying out and through this prophecy that your land, God, is going to be overflowed, the breadth of it is going to be covered. There's nothing in your land that's not going to be invaded by Syria. They're going to be swept and overtaken. Everything that belongs to the Lord, all of his people, all of his land is going to be overtaken by this great army. Now that's important. Because what has Isaiah just called Yahweh? Emmanuel. Isn't that amazing? Isaiah just referred to Yahweh as Emmanuel. The land belongs to Emmanuel. It's what we see here is even in this immediate fulfillment of Maher Shalal Hashbash, the son of Isaiah, being the sign of what God was going to do. Even in that immediate fulfillment, we understand right here from Isaiah that boy is not Emmanuel. He's not Emmanuel. So while there was that fulfillment right there in the time of Ahaz to let him know, hey, big boy, what God said he's going to do, he's fixing to let you have it. He's going to let you hold all you want. You wanted Assyria, you got him. But there's something greater in that prophecy that's coming. And the greater thing is this, Emmanuel is clearly right here in this verse. Emmanuel is Yahweh. He is the God of all the universe. So that changes our understanding of Emmanuel greatly, doesn't it? What we are looking at here is when we saw when we first talked about the idea of Emmanuel, because Emmanuel means what? God with us. And the way that that's worded is God in our presence. Yahweh himself with us. And there's no way that any human being like Maher Shalal Hashbash could have actually fulfilled that prophecy during that time, right? There's no way in history that could have happened. And so we're looking for something greater. We're looking for someone greater that's coming to ultimately fulfill this prophecy, right? And we have a prophecy and an understanding of a Messiah that's coming. There was promises that were made by God that were handed down from generation to generation, and ultimately he makes a promise to King David, who Ahaz comes from his bloodline, and we've talked about this a couple weeks ago. Ahaz should have known and understood the promises that God had given to his bloodline, that you are not going to lose your kingdom, you will not lose your throne, It is mine. Ultimately, someone on in your bloodline will sit on that throne forever. That was the promise of the Messiah that was given to David. And what we have here in this prophecy that is being carried on through Isaiah and is being proclaimed to Ahaz in that time is this, that even in the darkest part of this prophecy, even in this depth of despair where Assyria is going to wipe everything out, the army's going to come in up to the neck. There's going to be nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You're going to face the judgment of God. Even in the midst of that judgment from God, God still reminds them, I made you a promise. And I'm going to keep it. And I'm not going to let anybody else do it. I'm going to keep it. Emmanuel, God with us. The river, it may come up to the neck. It may rise up that high. But God is not going to drown out all of Israel because it is through them. It is through the Lion of Judah. The promise that was given to the line of David that through you is going to come that Messiah, that Deliverer, that promise that is given to that nation and ultimately is given to the whole world. So it may come up to the neck, but I'm not going to drown you all. I'm going to maintain that remnant. I'm going to maintain my people. There's going to be a remnant left over. Remember, that's a theme that we see over and over and over and over again in Isaiah. God protecting a remnant. God saving and keeping a people for himself in order to fulfill this promise. And so this river is not going to, the Assyrian invasion is not going to wipe them all out. God is with us. God is going to show up in a very unique way. It's not just going to be that he's going to provide help through some other earthly or worldly thing, but God himself is going to show up. He himself is going to show up ultimately in a person. In verse 9, we have a shift here in this imagery. No longer are we looking at Judah as a helpless people. And this comes right on the heels of God making that promise to them once again. In the midst of that judgment, here's my promise. I am coming. I will save you. So in verse 9, we have a shift, and Judah is no longer seen as a helpless people, but now they are told to be broken, to be shattered, to listen up. Everywhere the whole earth needs to listen to what's about to be said. Gird yourselves, take up your robes, tuck it in, get ready to run. God's made a promise. God's going to fulfill that promise. In verse 10, you can make a plan. He's talking to the whole earth. Listen to me, everybody. Every nation, every king, every ruler, every president, senator, whoever you want to talk to, every person in the world, listen to what God is about to say to you. You can devise a plan, but it's going to be thwarted. I'm going to overthrow it. You can state a proposal, but it will not stand. Why will it not stand? Look at the last part of verse 10. For God is with us. Judah is not helpless because Emmanuel, God with us, changes everything. It changes everything. Oh, broken peoples, he tells them to be broken. And he gives them the command to gird themselves, to get ready, tuck their robes in, and get ready to run. God with us. Interesting concept, isn't it? And we know we're coming into Christmas, and Emmanuel is something that's heavy on our minds and our hearts to meditate and ponder and to think through the incarnation of Christ, that the God, the ruler of the universe, taking on human flesh and a baby and living and growing in this world to the point where he becomes a man and shows us all righteousness, and dies on the cross to pay the penalty for our sin. Emmanuel, God with us. This is an interesting thing that we should be thinking and pondering about, because here is Yahweh who's making this promise. And in it being the idea of Emmanuel, it has to be God himself who does this. God has to do this. No man can do this. But it has to take place in real time and in real history. And so when you understand the concept of Emmanuel in the Old Testament, the idea of this otherworldly God coming here and living in real time is something that's very special. Ultimately, it's impossible for you and for me as humanity to be able to to obtain this unity with God. Even in the Old Testament, when you look at the way that God interacted with his people, it was always God coming to them, God coming to them, God coming to them. Even in the temple, when they would make the sacrifices and they would go, the priest would go into the Holy of Holies and he'd fill the room with the smoke, and then he would go in and in the proper way sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat. Even then, the mercy seat was there so that God could come to his people. He didn't approach God in their own way and in their own understanding. They only came to God through the way that he provided. God desires unity with humanity, but he knows humanity can't get to him. He knows that in the situation that we find ourselves in this world and in this lifetime, no matter what plans we make, no matter what actions we take, none of those are going to get us to God. Instead, he is the one who makes unity possible. And he does it. This is something that's so hard for some people to grasp and understand. Because why would a God like this, this otherworldly God, why would he want to come into this world and subject himself to the things of this world? Why would he want to do that? And yet that's exactly what God does. God brings unity to us by entering into this realm, real time in history. He enters into our mortality. And he does that so that he can bring us himself. Isn't that an amazing promise? An absolutely beautiful promise of Emmanuel that was made thousands of years ago. And we sit here tonight reading about this, studying about it. And we celebrate it over the next few weeks. God himself coming in the person of Jesus Christ in order to reconcile this world to himself. So I want you to hold on to that over the next few weeks and really think through that idea of God with us, Emmanuel, what God had to do in order to enter into this world. Why would he do it? All for the sake of making things right between you and him, of bringing you back to himself. That's a humbling thing. That is a very humbling thing.